Stan back here at Radio Liberty. coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it is going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you of the views that are expressed here and not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Please hold your calls for a few minutes till we have a chance to introduce and talk to our special guest this evening, Cal Grunwald. But we will have open lines, and if you'd like to call in and talk to Cal, Cal is one of the supporters of our program, and certainly we're going to be talking about what is happening financially in the world today. Now, it's really very interesting as we try to analyze what in heaven's name is going on in the world today. On the 7th of July, why we're told that four Al-Qaeda terrorists or terrorists of some sort were able to build sophisticated bombs. Of course, these bombs actually had timers on them, or at least had cell phone capacity for being exploded. They found several bombs like that that were left in a car. Why would you leave the bombs in the car where they could be found, as well as so much of the identification of the bombers? I mean, it almost is exactly like it was after 9/11, when supposedly Muhammad Atta left all of his identification, his suitcase, and other things in the car. If you were going to go and blow something up, why would you bring a suitcase along with you? There were so many unanswered questions about 9/11. For instance, we had advanced knowledge of 9/11, and the English had advanced knowledge of the attack on the 7th of July. How do we know that? Well, I read about six newspapers every day because they can't keep all the truth out of the newspapers. Once in a while, articles are going to sneak in there that really are true. And there was an excellent article in the Wall Street Journal pointing out that the Pakistan intelligence had captured a member of Al-Qaeda who had told them that the bombing of London was planned. And they had repeatedly told Great Britain that to anticipate bombing of the subway. But, of course, the English said, gee, we never got those warnings at all. In fact, immediately before the bombing, they lowered security so that it would make it easier for bombers to bomb the London subway. Now, that just doesn't make sense. But exactly the same thing happened in the United States. At one time, it was illegal to take box cutters and knives onto the planes, and they changed those regulations just before the 9/11 attack, knowing full well an attack was coming. In fact, up until 2 months before 9/11, it was legal for pilots to carry weapons onto their planes. I know because I talked to the head of the Pilots Association, who told me that 2 months before 9/11, the FAA put out a regulation that no longer could pilots carry a pistol onto the plane. Up to that time, it was legal for, and some of them actually did it. Now, knowing an attack was coming, and the FAA had been told repeatedly that the possibility of hijacking planes, why would you change those requirements? And then they made it easier for terrorists to get out of the plane on the morning of 9/11. Why, nine of the hijackers were actually stopped and questioned and then allowed to get on the planes. Well, all I can say is what really is so amazing about the July 7th bombing this year is that on July 7th, the terrorists knew how to make bombs that would go off, and 2 weeks later they'd forgotten, and all the bombs fizzled. Isn't that amazing? I could imagine one of them fizzling, maybe two of them, maybe three of them, but all of them would fizzle. How could they forget so quickly within 2 weeks how to build a bomb, or was it all psychological? Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. I guess this evening, Cal Grunwald. And we might ask, well, why are we having more bombings here in the United States? And I would like to suggest if we were to have a lot of terrorist acts here, why it could really severely impact the economy, already rather on shaky grounds. And So it's, well, we get almost the same impact of having them over in Great Britain. Certainly it strikes terror in the hearts of the American people, but we have not had a single major terrorist attack in the United States in almost 4 years. And the question is, if Al-Qaeda is out there and really such a menace, and Osama bin Laden is planning on more attacks on America, why haven't there been any attacks? It must be that either Al-Qaeda has really total control over all the Islamic terrorists and terrorist cells that we're told are in the United States, or our government has a monitor and they're afraid to act. Well, because I believe if we did have a terrorist attack, and I believe a terrorist attack is coming at some time in the future, it will have a profound impact upon the economy of this country. And that is the background. Cal Grunwald, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, it's good to be back, Dr. Stan.
Well, as we look at the economy, you know, the market goes up one day, goes down the next, but it really isn't going anyplace. The same thing happens with NASDAQ, right? It goes up a little bit, it goes down a little bit. Gold and silver really haven't been done too much in the last couple of months. They're just sort of sitting there. Silver moved up well and then, of course, seemed to fall back again. What indeed is going on in the gold and silver market? What's going on with the stock market? What's going on with the economy?
Well, it's, again, the heavy manipulation by the government, especially in the gold and silver price and the stock market. It's just all, it's all manipulation, so nothing is true. Nothing follows the science or physics, if you will, economic physics. And that's what confuses people. So they're just, people just sit there and wonder what's really going on. And as a result, don't really take action, the action that they should, knowing what's happening with the economy worldwide. It's a disaster. The economy in our country is no better either. You know, the Fed's raising rates. But in the backdoor printing, you know, just bales and bales of money and issuing it. So it's, you know, rampant inflation is on the way, and people don't seem to see anything because they read the newspapers, they read Wall Street's propaganda, and they believe it. So that's why they don't understand.
Well, I certainly think that is true. And unless people read things besides what they can get in the regular newspapers, unless they understand the manipulation of our economy and the plunge protection team, they can't understand what's going on. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Cal Grunwald. And Cal believes that everything is being manipulated. He believes the stock market is being manipulated by the government, and I believe that's absolutely true. There's something known as the plunge protection team, and it correlates the Treasury and certainly many of the major stockbrokers and some of the big banks, and their function is to keep the market from tumbling, to keep it more or less stable, because what they want, at least temporarily, is stability here in the United States. They manipulate the price of gold. They manipulate the price of silver. And it's all illegal, but who are you going to report that to? And time and again, when the price of gold or silver should respond to what's going on, they do absolutely nothing. The price of oil is going up because they want the price of oil to go up because they want to get you out of your cars. And if you've read the Agenda 21 and the Global Biodiversity Assessment that came out of the Rio Summit back in 1992, you'd understand that the only way that they're going to get people out of their cars, which is their major goal and objective, is, of course, to get the price of oil up high. And I believe you haven't seen anything yet. I think it's just going to keep going up. What are your thoughts, Cal?
Well, that's very true. I mean, we're on the verge of $3 gasoline, and, you know, for gasoline to get $5, $6, $7 is right around the corner, and eventually there will be no gasoline in available for the public. That's their intent, just like you said.
Well, of course, they'll have it for the elite, the government bureaucrats, the government officials will have it. And, you know, if you can afford to pay $6, $7, $8 a gallon, you'll be able to get it. But they really do intend to run the prices up because they can run the price up any time they want to. The oil companies, we're told, are awash in cash. Well, how can they be making all this money if this has to do with market forces? And I would like to suggest it doesn't. It's all manipulated. Everything is perception. And they control the reality of the American people. Well, you know, one of the things that, of course, we keep reading about is the housing bubble. And Alan Greenspan has really warned against this housing bubble. He's making demands that certainly Freddie Mac and Freddie Mae, which is the large previously government lending agencies, and whether they're still government sponsored, nobody really knows. It's sort of vague. But they're talking about limiting their ability to make housing loans. What would really happen to our economy when this housing bubble really bursts?
Well, the only thing that's keeping our economy going is the refi. I call it the refi and buy.
Another refinancing of homes.
You refi your house and then you buy. You buy toys, you buy cars, you buy frivolous things. You keep the economy going, because 70% of our economy is consumption. And if we don't keep consuming, and if the government can't keep us consuming, we're going down fast. So it's a frenzy. It's just a refinance frenzy and a buying frenzy, and Americans are still doing it.
But, of course, we have no savings in this country. Most people in other countries are saving for their old age. Most people are saving because they believe that having money or gold or silver or something of tangible value will give them a certain amount of security. It seems that here in the United States there's sort of an organized insanity, and nobody really seems to be putting aside for their retirement, and yet so many of our pension funds are really in very, very poor shape. And in fact, if you read the financial papers as I do, many of these major major pension funds are in real shape. And if certainly if the stock market were to drop, why, they would be even in worse shape. And what's going to happen to the people? Certainly, you can't live on Social Security today.
No, and see, the whole thing that started this gold rush was back in the 2003. The Japanese banks got in big trouble because they were insolvent. They loaned money at 0% interest, and so they finally decided to eat some crow and admit that they weren't doing a good job, and they reduced the guarantee on personal savings accounts from unlimited to $75,000 per account. Well, the Japanese, like you said, they're savers. You know, they're wise people. They saw the handwriting on the wall, so to speak, and so most of them cashed in their life savings, went down to the gold dealer and walked home with 20, 30, 40 pounds of gold under their arm. And that jumped gold $50 an ounce, you know, worldwide. And it's been, you know, kind of going up ever since. Of course, the government's capped it severely now. But gold demand is strong. In fact, India is the largest buyer of gold, and they're purchasing gold in the first quarter was up 72% over last year. And of course, the public will never hear these things because that's reality. I just found out too that China was able, of course, for the first time in 100 years, buy gold, but they could only buy a certificate for gold. They couldn't actually own the metal itself until 2 weeks ago. China opened the door for their citizens to own the physical metal for the first time since 1948.
And I think that's really very interesting that the Chinese now have been allowed to own gold. The Indians apparently allowing the importation of substantial amounts of gold because the Indian economy is booming. Of course, it would be booming. So many of the American jobs are going overseas. I had a gentleman call me earlier in the week. Very, very successful builder in the East, does a lot of very large buildings. He was mentioning that into his office had come just the day before two gentlemen, very well dressed, very articulate, spoke perfect English. They were Indians from India, and they were architects, and they were asking about if he would be willing to let them do some work for him. And he said, well, do you have an office? And he said, oh, no, we don't have an office. And he said, well, you know, you can't do architecture in the United States unless you have people to look up the codes and the planning commission and file all the forms. Oh, they said, we have people that can do it here, and we don't need an office in the United States. We can hire that work done, and we can overnight plans that you want overnight from India. We can send them here. And of course, their prices were ever so much better than anything here in the United States you could get for architecture. And as my friend said, he said, you just couldn't believe their resume, their training, their ability, the organization behind them. So we're going to increasingly seeing our architectural jobs, our engineering jobs, our computer jobs, our support jobs, our telephone answering services, all going to India. I had lunch just yesterday with a friend who was telling me, he was talking to somebody who was making reservations for Delta Airlines, and it was a very nice lady, and my friend said, well, I guess it's pretty hot there in Atlanta, their headquarters for Delta. Oh, she said, I'm in New Delhi. And the thing was amazing. She didn't have a bit of an accent. She spoke so articulately, and now Delta Airlines is offshoring their reservation arrangements. All of our corporations are doing that. So India is doing very well. They're making a lot of money. They're taking our jobs. And now these people are beginning to buy gold. So we're beginning to see people throughout the rest of the world understanding you want something of value. And here in America, the attitude seems to be, nothing bad is ever going to happen here. Let's eat, drink, and be merry let's eat, drink, and be merry.
Well, that's very true. In fact, several months ago, I was talking to somebody from Penny's who was talking about a bill that I had. And, again, perfect English, articulate. And then I got a little bit upset with her for there being unreasonable, charging a $25 late fee. On a $43 bill that I had. And so I said, where are you from? She said, India. I said, no, where do you live? India. You're calling from India? It was just like she was next door. She perfect English, everything. So you're right. It's all going over there. And it seems like we can't do anything about it.
Well, of course, this is the master plan. For our listeners out there, you must understand the reason we're not trying to stop immigration, the reason our borders are open, is because our leaders have no loyalty to the United States. They want a world without borders, but they can't tell the American people that they are betraying their oath to uphold our Constitution. And what they're really doing is transferring America's jobs, America's factories, America's wealth throughout the rest of the world. Right now, things aren't bad. You may lose your job, but you can get another one. Won't pay as well, won't be as good benefits. But that job may very well go soon, and then the next job won't be pay anywhere near as much. And people must understand that what they really are intending to do, and it's all laid out in the Earth Charter, which was written by that great American patriot, Mikhail Gorbachev, along with Marie Strong and Stephen Rockefeller. It's the Earth Charter. You can pull it down off the Internet, or we'll send you a free copy. It's the redistribution of wealth within nations and between nations, and they are intentionally and maliciously destroying the infrastructure of America. We are under attack from within, and while our attention is focused on what's going on in Iraq, while our attention is focused on Michael Jackson, when our attention is focused on Tom Cruise, and when our attention is focused on all sorts of unimportant issues like baseball and now the coming football season, why the future of America is being transferred to other countries throughout the world to bring about true equality and the destruction of America as we know it. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. When you understand that what is going on is long-term planning, our leaders know exactly what they're doing. CAFTA, of course, is the next nail in the coffin of American sovereignty, the Central America Free Trade Zone. They know what they're doing. They just don't want the Americans to know. And when they say, oh, look at all those jobs, they're simply lying. And when somebody tells you that CAFTA or NAFTA or the Free Trade Zones of the America or the World Trade Organization are beneficial for America, why, they simply are incredibly foolish or stupid, or they don't see what's happening to America, or they want to destroy this country. And once you can understand there truly are evil people, there really are people who want to destroy the United States, then everything makes sense. We're going to be back here in just a moment with our special guest this evening, Cal Grunwald, and we're going to invite your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Well, Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening, Cal Grunewald. And Cal, you know, are people really getting into the gold and silver market today, or are they sort of avoiding it at the present time? Or is it simply that when nothing much is happening, nobody's interested?
Well, again, despite all the manipulation and the prices remaining low and the government keeping them that way, an amazing number of people are waking up and are paying attention and are buying gold and silver because they're, it's because of programs like yours and others. The minority is growing, and they're paying attention to what's really going on underneath because they're seeing as they're being educated, and they are buying gold and silver in increasing numbers. So I've seen a very, very strong response in the last few months, and it's getting stronger. People just aren't really sitting on the fence anymore. They do see what's going on to a large extent, and they are doing something about it. So it's in one way really encouraging to me that people are paying attention and they're doing something to convert some of their paper or electronic money into real money, which is gold and silver, and fleeing institutions, because they're not really doing that yet, but getting out of the fickle institutions like banks and stock market, getting out of the CDs and getting away from insurance companies somewhat to secure their finances with gold and silver. So I'm encouraged by that.
Well, now what about are they getting more into silver? Are they getting more into gold?
Well, of course, I really stress silver a lot because that's what you're going to use to barter with. The dimes, quarters, and halves that were 90% silver before 1965, our currency. I stress that first, and then once people have that, like a bag of silver in place, then if you want to preserve whatever wealth you need to or you want to with gold, then they're getting into gold. So silver is very important first and foremost, and then gold after that.
All right, Chris, do you think silver has a better upside potential than gold does or not?
Well, definitely. The problem becomes the volume and the bulk and the weight. And again, I stress with the people I talk to, we're not looking for investment potential or profit potential here. We're looking to have something practical to barter with, something that's going to work on a day-to-day basis. So, if silver multiplies, 7 to 10 times and gold multiplies 4 to 5 times, it's really kind of a moot issue because you're talking about having something to barter with and preserving wealth. And of course, gold is the ultimate contact store value. So people with a lot of money, they might have a bag of two or silver. If you've got two bags of silver, you've got 110 pounds of coins. And that's kind of cumbersome to haul around or to hide conveniently. So I just recommend, a half a bag or a bag, per household, which is great plenty. And then the rest of your wealth that you want to protect, put it in the gold because it's a very compact store value. It can easily be hidden. If you ever have to go someplace fast, you can grab your gold and you can go, but your silver, is pretty bulky. So I don't talk to people about upside potential or profit potential when it comes to silver, just the practicality of the barter.
Well, now, is silver still available to dealers? In other words, is there beginning to be a shortage? You would think that unless people are cashing their silver in, if they're keeping it, one of these days they're going to run out of bags of silver.
Well, that's very true. There have been periods of time in the last maybe year or so when...
Hold that thought for just a moment there, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Cal Grunewald. And Cal is saying that there seems to be an increased interest in gold and silver in the last few months. Of course, he is in the business. He's saying that, despite the fact that nothing seems to be happening, there seems to be an increasing, at least on the part of certain people, an increased awareness that things are not very good. Maybe people have read that article by Paul Volcker on the 10th of April of this year, an article he wrote for the Washington Post, where he said everything looks pretty placid. I mean, everything looks like it's everything's going pretty well, but I think we're skating on very thin ice. And then he talked about how there is no instance in all history where a nation has has been spending more than it's taking in, and we're spending more than we're taking in, and been able to do that indefinitely, and the central banks of the world are not going to continue to take American money. Now, Paul Volcker should know, because he works hand in glove with the central banks throughout the rest of the world, when he tells us that the other banks are not going to continue honoring our currency indefinitely, he knows what's going to happen. And then, of course, he talked about the fact we have no savings, the fact that many of the major industries are beginning to accumulate money. I mean, they're making big profits. Of course, they're producing at very low prices over in the Orient, and then they're bringing the products in here. So many of the corporations are doing very well, as the average American is losing his job, as his salary is being eroded by inflation. And, of course, his savings are being destroyed by the inflationary process, if he has any. So the corporations are doing very well. The average American is not doing that well if he's actually out in the labor field. And Paul Volcker anticipates, according to the article, and you can get it off of Google, Paul Volcker, Washington Post, April 10th, and he anticipates a financial crisis. And so, since he's one of the insiders, he's former chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, I think you can certainly trust that he knows what's going to happen. The only question I have is, why is he warning the American people what lies ahead? So, you know, as we look and see these things happening, I think we have to begin making preparations for difficult times. And Cal says that he's seeing more and more people actually doing that. I asked him if there was a shortage of bags of silver. And what was your response, Cal?
Well, again, at times in the last year, it's been very, very difficult. A couple of my suppliers just didn't have any silver at all. And that was rather alarming when I called up with an order. So I was always able to get one from one of my suppliers, but it's rather unnerving when you call up. Another time I called one of my suppliers, they didn't have any, very few gold pieces left, whether it was bullion or old gold or whatever it was. And I've had some gold hit around 440. There was like a buying frenzy, a small one. And then, of course, the government, you know, knocks gold down again, and things kind of calm down and loosen up again. But the government fears gold getting up around 450, 460, because that will panic people, and then gold could really take off. So they're they're capping it very severely. There is an availability problem right now. It's not severe, but there is one.
All right. So it should be pretty obvious to the American people that the markets are manipulated. Our reality is being manipulated. Our minds are molded. Our tastes are formed. Our ideas suggested largely by a man we have never heard of. That statement was made by Edward Bernays 76 years ago. Edward Bernays, the father of American propaganda, that's how he opens his book, entitled Propaganda, written in 1929. And certainly Edward Bernays, who was Sigmund Freud's nephew, Edmund Bernays, understands what's going on and how, through propaganda, governments can become, or a group could become, the invisible government of our society. Well, let's go. We've got Rick calling in from Arizona, so we'll take him in just a moment as soon as our call screener screens him over to us. Probably we'll welcome your other calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And we lost Rick from Arizona. Hope he'll call back in again. And when he does, I think we'll take him directly. We seem to be having some difficulty of passing one line to the other. Don't know why that is, but that happened this afternoon. So when we get back, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And we'll be back in just a moment with our special guest, Cal Grunwald, and try to get you understanding that there was an organized effort to destroy the economy of our country, to impoverish our people. And, of course, when that happens, why, I think you're going to find that unfortunately, the American people will turn to government that has created the problem in an effort to solve the very problem that they themselves have created. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Cal Grunwald, and we're simply talking about what's happening with the economy. Well, what's going to happen as far as the housing bubble? How long do you think it's going to keep going, Cal?
Well, of course, the government has a way of stringing everything that they want. It seems to be as long as they want, and who knows how long this housing bubble is going to go, but it's growing day by day, especially out where you live. Who knows how long it's going to last, but when it does burst, a lot of people are going to find themselves bankrupt and in the street because they've been living off their, you know, the equity in their you know, house is just like a mirage.
And it's,
the whole thing is just like a mirage.
I had a friend of mine who bought one home in Las Vegas and put a down payment on two condos in Florida that weren't built. They were just in the process of being built. They've just completed both of them. He's put them on the market. He's made $50,000 more on each condominium that he paid for it, and he's going to make out like a bandit. And that is really what's happening in Florida. The prices are zooming up, as they're zooming up here in California and a number of other places throughout the country. But there's absolutely nothing behind this. It's like the tulip mania. It's like the frantic buying we had of stocks back in 2000, NASDAQ stocks, Dow Jones stocks. Well, let's go to Bill, who's calling from Idaho. Hi, Bill. How are you doing?
Hi, Stan. For you and your guests, a question. Evidently, in the last couple of months, the federal government has made a law that seems to be very convenient for the bankers, and they're starting now to put this out on the news that they're going to be doubling the minimum due on credit cards. And my intuition is that this is going to start a big snowball of people that won't be able to make their minimum due payments. Do you have any comments on that?
Mikhail, do you have any comment at all on what Bill was saying?
Well, I haven't heard that.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. I think it was, I don't know, it was 10% before, and it's 20% now. Well, Bill, what is it? They did increase it, but I'm not sure exactly how much.
As best I know, it's roughly around 2% that they're going to be upping to, say, 5%.
Okay, fine.
The point is only relevant in regards to the fact that if somebody can't make, or if they're barely making the minimum due now because they're stretched so thin, what's going to happen with all of these credit cards that are out there in everybody's pocket?
Well, Chris,
they can't make the payment.
Well, Bill, do you understand why they've increased the amount of payment that they have to make? Do you understand why that the government did that?
I would assume it's because of the banking lobby.
No, basically what they want to do is slow down people's buying so much. In other words, they're trying to begin to put dampers onto to our spending spree, the people's spending spree. We'll be back in just a moment here. This is Dr. Stan back here, and we have Bill calling from Idaho, and he commented that recently it was the Federal Reserve or the SEC or whoever it was who regulates credit cards had demanded they increase the minimum payment on credit cards from 2 to 5%. And, you know, of course the question was, why are they doing this? Cal, what's your impression? Why do you think they're doing this?
Well, it's again more oppression. They're tightening the screws on everybody to get them where they want them. You know, apparently their system isn't happening fast enough, or their plan isn't happening fast enough, so they want to accelerate it to get us where they want us.
I think, Bill, what they're trying to do is to get people to stop spending so much, and I think that this is probably the first in a series of incremental changes in the economic situation. As you know, they've changed the bankruptcy laws, so it's increasingly difficult to go bankrupt. Why would they change the bankruptcy laws? Because they're expecting a lot of people to go bankrupt. And these people, of course, are not going to be able to get out from under their debts as they have in the past. It was easy to go out and spend and spend, and then when you just no way you could pay your debts, then you simply went bankrupt and left the banks holding the bag. Well, this way, you're not going to be able to do that. You're going to end up holding the bag. So I think this is the first step along the way towards beginning to dampen down our economy and try to stop people from spending so much.
Is this a coincidence? Does it seem to line up quite nicely with everybody overextended with their mortgages?
Absolutely.
And heavily. And if the interest rates start rising, they may not be able to make their payments.
Absolutely.
And I'm just wondering where they think that when they get the public to a point where they won't be able to come up with their mortgage payment or come up with their credit card payment, with, you know, is it here comes debtor's prison?
No, I mean, you're not going to put you in prison. They're just going to be in debt. So, you know, when you have a job, well, they'll take a certain percentage of what you make, like they do with the deadbeat dads. You don't have anything to say about it. You got a job, they're going to take 10, 15, 20, 30% of that. And if you want to keep your job, you're going to have to pay it.
And maybe possibly in the future pass along debt to the children.
Who knows, you know. We're in real trouble, and they know exactly what they're doing. And there's an old adage that the debtor is always a servant to the lender. And we are becoming increasingly indentured servants.
Well, they seem to have done this quite nicely on purpose. They've given easy credit cards away. They've given easy no-down mortgages away. And now they're starting to squeeze everybody.
But it's happened hundreds of times through the history of our country. I mean, it happened back, you know, during the Revolutionary War. It happened back in the early 1800s. It happened, you know, during the time of Andrew Jackson. There's nothing new under the sun. It's just the average American doesn't understand how the bankers manipulate the system to their own advantage.
Well, that's why we went to war in 1776, is it not? Because we were getting squeezed in this fashion with money.
Yes, but of course, immediately after 1776, once we established the American government, why we established a central bank, and you'd never guess who one of the major stockholders were. It was the very people in England who, of course, laid the foundation for the Revolutionary War. And that's what happened. Congress refused to ratify the charter, or renew the charter of the first Bank of the United States, and then, of course, the charter ended in 1811, and who knows why the next year we were at war, the War of 1812. And so Congress was forced to charter then the second Bank of the United States in 1816. And, of course, the bankers expanded the money supply and got everybody in debt. And then when Andrew Jackson refused to renew the charter in 1832, because they were trying to get it renewed 4 years before it was set to expire, Because the second Bank of the United States was largely owned by the same people from England who'd owned the first Bank of the United States. And then, of course, they contracted the economy. And, of course, people lost their farms, they lost their businesses, and they lost their homes. There's nothing new under the sun. Would you agree with that, Cal?
Well, that's exactly what we're seeing now happen. Raising interest rates, getting everybody oppressed very, very nicely. And lower the guillotine, and then, you know, you got people right where the government's got people right where they want them.
Amen. Okay, thanks so much, Bill. Let's go to Connie, K-O-N-N-Y, calling from Texas. Hi, how are you doing?
Hi.
How do you pronounce your name?
Connie.
Connie, okay, Connie.
Yes. I would like to know, when other countries are buying our debt, what backs up that debt? Why would they buy our debt?
All right, that's a good question. Why are other countries buying American debt, Cal?
Well, again, the dollar has been the premier currency, you know, in the world, and those people must think there's some value in it still, so that's why they do it.
The reason that they're doing it, Connie, is originally the American dollar was backed by gold, and it was backed up by gold until 1971. After that, America's dollar was still the premier currency of the world, and it became the reserve currency of the world. But in recent years, as we began spending much more than we're taking in, as this country is becoming increasingly unreliable, foreign countries are increasingly trying to get out of debt because they do not trust our currency, and that is exactly what Paul Volcker said in his article in the Washington Post on the 10th of April. But if they sell all of their American dollars at one time, like for instance China has about almost $700 billion in American currency, and if they were to dump that on the market, the price would plummet and they would lose out. And the same is true with other countries, so they're very subtly trying to get out of American dollars.
So they are trying to get out,
yes,
though?
Yes, they're trying to get out, and what's happening apparently is that we're having difficulty selling our currency on the international markets, and so suddenly orders are coming in out of the Cayman Islands from sources unknown, and many people think that the Federal Reserve is simply creating money out of nothing to buy our own debt, which, of course, is highly inflationary and down the line will result in terrible complications for us. The other countries are trying to get out of the dollar. People are trying to get out of the dollar at one time. The greenback was sought throughout the entire world. And even the Russian mafia in Russia is trying to get out of the dollar.
Well, that's hard to understand, that Cayman Island thing where we're trying to buy our own debt.
Well, you have to really understand that it is all a house of cards. It's all like a house of mirrors. There's really no reality to it at all. Have you ever studied our economic system and how it works? The fact that it's all built upon debt. It's a house of cards built upon sand.
Well, I heard it was built on debt.
Right.
And that if we didn't have any debt, then it would all fall apart.
Right.
And that was also hard for me to understand.
Well, I'll tell you what, the best book on this we have two of them. One is called The Creature from Jekyll Island, which I think gives an excellent overview of the debt system. The other is called The Federal Reserve Conspiracy by Professor Sutton, and he did a great job of explaining how it fits together. Second book's really rather simple, but I think the important thing is for people to understand that, as Paul Volcker said, we're skating on very thin ice, and you better start making preparations for the future, because there's not going to be anybody looking after you. What would your advice be to Connie, Cal?
Well, I would, of course, that book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, I really like that book. It's very, very well written, Edward Griffin. I would read that.
I didn't know it was written by Griffin?
Yeah, Edward Griffin,
yeah,
right.
Edward Griffin.
Oh, yeah? I didn't know that.
Right.
Very, very good book. Another thing I would highly recommend is that you send for my information packet.
Now, why don't you tell her how to get your information packet and get with you?
I've got a 26-page paper that I've written entitled Gold and How to Avoid the Scams in the Coin Industry. And that kind of warns people, educates people about all the scams that are out there. And they seem to be increasing as the interest increases. Not only the number of companies, but the number of scam companies. It's just like, you know, the bad ones multiply and produce more scams. Also, in my information package, I have an article on the gold in Fort Knox. It's no longer there. It tells a very, very interesting story how Lyndon Johnson got rid of our gold reserves for us. And there's another document called the Emergency Banking Order in my package of information, which basically allows the banks to do whatever they want to do in a time of a crisis. They can close their doors anytime they want. And if you have money in the banks, a financial institution, they can close them and you're just stuck, just like the people in Argentina.
Okay, how can people get in touch with you?
So my phone number is 414-234-8267.
One more time.
414-234-8267, and then I'll be glad to send that package of information at no charge to you.
All right, fine.
And,
anything else you wanted to ask there, Connie?
Well, you know, I was thinking that, you know, when we have cash saved instead of like gold or silver, that it seems like it's not the thing to save.
You're absolutely right. In
fact, it seems like if it gets devalued, we just won't have anything.
That's right, and the whole idea is to impoverish the American people, as it says in the Earth Charter, to redistribute wealth between nations. They know what they're doing, they just don't want you to know.
And it seems like, you know, when they had that eminent domain scandal going on,
right?
It seems like if they want to take our land away from us, which I mean, if they wanted to, they could. I don't know if they could or not, but
they can do whatever they want to.
When are they going to take the gold away?
Well, that's the thing, that they may very well. There is nothing you can do when, of course, when you have a tyrannical government. The only thing is that they're going to have a hard time, because I think there are an awful lot of people out there who, if they do tell them to turn in the gold, they may lose it.
What do you mean?
Well, they may not be able to find it.
Oh, that people wouldn't turn it in.
Well, I'm not suggesting anybody do that, but that's a possibility. That is what's happened in other countries. You know, it's a most amazing thing. When the government does one thing, well, the people always react just the opposite. When the government raises taxes, people quit working. The government raises taxes because they want more money, and they end up getting less money. When the government lowers taxes, people work harder, and the government makes more by lowering taxes. You always get a reverse action from what, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Now, we took a tour one time of the great mansions down along the Mississippi. And these were built, you know, at the time of the Civil War before. And there are no closets in these beautiful rooms there, the bedrooms. Why? Because they taxed you if you had a closet, so they didn't put in closets. There were no inside staircases because there was a tax on inside staircases, so all the staircases were outside staircases. And whatever the government does to take money away from the people always find a means around it. Okay, Connie?
Okay, thank you.
God bless. And let's go to Rick calling from Arizona. Hi, Rick. How are you doing?
Pretty good. And yourself?
Just fine, thanks. Do you have a question for our guest?
Yes, I do.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay.
Don't be bashful.
Oh, okay. Is this Dr. Stan?
It is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Cal Grunwald.
I'm here, too.
My question is, are you a free market capitalist?
Am I a free market capitalist? No, I believe in free enterprise. I don't believe in capitalism. Capitalism is a monopoly system.
Well, obviously. Well, okay. So that pretty much negates my first question. I guess, the question about the borders being closed and whatnot, then therefore you encourage state involvement in the capitalist system.
No, I don't believe in capitalism, I just told you. And I believe we should have tariffs.
Let's not call it capitalism. Let's call it the free market.
Right. And I believe in the free market. I believe in a level playing field. And there is no level playing field. Let me finish, Rick.
Okay.
When
sorry.
We have American workers competing with people who work for 50 cents an hour, is that a level playing field?
Right. Well, those things are mostly, brought up and built up by unions and whatnot.
Right. So you would like more of a
communistic system.
All right. Fine. So you would like to have then open borders.
I would like to have open borders. I'd like to be able to move out of this country if I could, and move anywhere else in the world I pleased.
You can. You can move everywhere you want to.
No, I can't.
Why not?
Oh, because it's economically impossible.
That's exactly right. And if we adopted your system, why, we would have no wealth in America. Thanks for calling. And let's go to Ron, who's calling from Washington. Go ahead, Ron.
Dr. Stan?
Right.
I just wanted to ask a question about the balance of payments. I heard Dr. Walter Williams, he's an economist, he's on Rush Limbaugh, and right. he tended to trivialize that. He said, well, I have a balance of payments problems with the grocer. I pay money and I get goods.
All right.
But there's no problem. And that didn't seem to sit too right with me.
All right. How would you respond to what Ron is saying, Cal? He's quoting Walter Williams, who ordinarily in most instances is a very reliable individual, but he's saying we have no problem with the balance of payments system. He has problems with buying his groceries. He has the balance of payments problems. How would you respond to that?
Well, I guess I really don't understand the question as it applies to our economy or individuals.
I think
clarify that.
Basically, what certainly have to understand where Walter Williams is coming from. He's an economist. He's also a libertarian, and the libertarians say we should have no tariffs. We should have no border controls. We should simply open our borders, and eventually the whole world will, equalize. And that's true. We will impoverish our people. The people throughout the rest of the world will be impoverished, and we'll all be, of course, impoverished together. I think Walter Williams is wrong. I think he's a brilliant man, but I think that he has failed to understand the spiritual forces that are intent upon destroying this country.
What I would say is he fails to understand the fact that we have balance.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you see, it may have a balance of payments deficit with the grocer. He has a positive balance of payments from his employer. And if you're just sending money out, and you're never making any money yourself, eventually you're going to go bankrupt.
That's absolutely right. You have a balance of payments, a problem with your grocer for a long period of time. Pretty soon your grocer doesn't give you any more groceries. And that's what's going to happen here. You have to understand that the founding fathers of America were pretty smart. They put tariffs on this to keep out foreign goods, to build up our economy and build up our manufacturing. Because we were a wealthy enough nation, we did not need the nations throughout the rest of the world. And we did not need an income tax because they made enough money to finance the central government with tariffs and with customs levies. But you see, the goal of our leaders is not a strong America. It is to redistribute the wealth of this country. And the people are advocating open borders, as our previous caller already wanted to redistribute our wealth to the other nations. He doesn't want to go to another nation because he couldn't make it economically there. That's absolutely right. But of course, we are going to continue doing what we're doing. We're going to destroy this country. That's exactly what's going on. I disagree with Walter Williams. He's a brilliant man, but he's absolutely wrong. Anything else, Ron?
No, sir. Thank you very much.
God bless. Cal, let's get your telephone number off one more time.
Yes, 414-234-8267.
One more time.
414-234-8267.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment here with Cal. Well, Cal, we are going to be give you about 3 minutes to wrap up the program this evening. What's the message you would like to leave with our listeners?
Well, as I talk to people, I emphasize how important it is to secure the wealth that you've already made. And it's not the time to trust in institutions that are fickle, you know, from the start, like your banks, your credit unions, the insurance companies, the stock market, the money markets, the CDs, all these paper electronic mirages. Now's not the time to be looking to, you know, make a quick dollar, but preserve the dollar that you've worked hard, you know, to earn. And so, with all the people, you know, in this country being, most of the people in this country being propagandized by the media is getting more and more deceptive. The misinformation and the propaganda is getting, you know, deeper and deeper. It's just like you were talking about Al Qaeda and the bombs that didn't go off. I mean, all these smoke screens that we get in, you know, confronted with every day. People need to look at the reality of their own lives, their own finances, and you know, how are you going to provide for your family in the days when the dollar does fail, when there is no value in it anymore, when all the financial institutions that people trusted are closed. How are you going to survive? What are you going to do? And that's why it goes back to scripture. You know, the gold and silver are the only money. And the Lord said it, and it's always been true. It always will be. So people with some wealth that they've accumulated should look at, you know, putting some of it in gold and silver in a very, very practical way, having it with you. That way you don't have to trust institutions that don't really care about you. Not that you trust your gold and silver, but at least it's something real that you can have to fall back on when times get bad, when there is no currency. History has shown how World War II, many of the Jews bought passage to the United States or England with gold coins that they had sewn in their overcoats. You know, British soldiers dropped behind enemy lines had British sovereigns that they could give to the peasants, and you know, they were hidden from the enemy. The, you know, history is full of these accounts if you just look for them. And so I would encourage people to, you know, put a portion, basically whatever you don't want to lose, put it into gold and silver, and then keep it with you.
All right. Well, thank you so very much for being with us, Cal. I appreciate your thoughts, and we'll look forward to talking again sometime next month, okay?
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Good night. God bless. And ladies and gentlemen, I believe we're living in very, very difficult times. There are those who destroy America. They're doing a pretty good job. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course, to really understand what is going on today. and what is energizing everything. I would suggest that you seriously consider getting our latest newsletter. It's called The Occult Hierarchy, Part 2. And you can actually get that off of our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Or you can simply, if you don't have access to the Internet, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And if you ask for The Occult Hierarchy, Part 2, or the June newsletter, we'll send that to you. And there really are a group of people who run and control this country. Now, if you don't know who the occult hierarchy are, and you doubt what I am telling you, the fact that there is such a group, that they have people at the highest levels of our government, and they have a plan, and they refer to as with a capital P, the plan with a capital P, meaning that this is a deified program. Why, you can go to Google on the Internet and type in occult hierarchy, and you'll find a whole page of references to the Theosophists. This is their plan. These are some of the most powerful and wealthy people in the country. They work in concert with the Lucis Trust, which has offices in Bern, Switzerland, and London, and, of course, in New York. They used to be at right in number one United Nations Plaza. They moved a little away from there because they're a Luciferian organization, and the last thing they wanted was for the American people to realize that the force behind the United Nations is Luciferian. When you understand that, everything makes sense. We're moving towards a one-world dictatorship. We're moving towards a one-world religion. We're moving towards a one-world currency. And the people who would, of course, do away with our borders obviously know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want the American people to know. And when we hear idealistic people and good people like Walter Williams saying, oh, we shouldn't have, tariffs and borders, and we want free and open trade. And this is, of course, the stepping stone to doing away with national sovereignty, to doing away with national currency, to doing away with national government. And, of course, the advent of the one-world government. If you'd like a copy of the Earth Charter, we'd be glad to provide one for you if you call us at 1-800-544-8927. And, of course, you can pull that down off the Internet, though. It was written by Gorbachev and Marie Strong and Stephen Rockefeller, who is Nelson Rockefeller's son. They have a program. It is the program which is being carried out by our leaders today, the leaders of both political parties. We have to get the information to the American people. We do have an opportunity to expand our ministry to 18 additional stations for the first hour in the evening. And if you're in a position to help us, why, we'd certainly appreciate that. And we'll know, hopefully, very soon if we're going to be able to do that. So if you'd like to help Radio Liberty expand to 18 additional stations for this hour, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. 8927. If you're interested in knowing more about Ed Griffin's book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, or Professor Sutton's book, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, and you really need to understand that the Federal Reserve System is a privately owned central bank. They call it Federal Reserve simply to confuse the American people, to deceive the American people, because they always use words to deceive. And they say one thing, and they mean another. Like, I'll never forget the Tax Simplification Act of 1986. The purpose was to make the taxes more complex. And, of course, everybody knows the alternative medium minimum tax was for the very wealthy, but it is really for the average individual. They say one thing, they mean another, and the average American cannot believe people would actually lie about their objectives and goals, but the reality is they would. Again, our number, 1-800-544-8927. Our website, RadioLiberty.com. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so, we'll be back here in just a few minutes with the next hour here. We'll be talking about Pearl Harbor. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line David Wade. And he's written a fascinating book called Infamy Revisited. Now, it is the story of Pearl Harbor. And why is that important? Well, very simply, because if you do not understand Pearl Harbor, you cannot understand the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. You can't understand what happened on 9/11. You can't even understand what happened on July 7th of this month. You have to go back to Pearl Harbor. And you have to understand that the entire media was mobilized to deceive the American people. The intelligence agencies, the FBI, mass media, cooperated to conceal the truth from the American people. And do you realize that to this very day, much of the information, much of the evidence of what happened that day of infamy, December 7th, 1941, is still classified and unavailable to the American people? And I would simply ask you, do you think we're concealing that information from Emperor Hirohito? Do you think we don't want the Japanese to know we'd broken their codes beforehand? Or do you think they're concealing what happened on December 7th, 1941, because they don't want the American people to know the truth, that the President of the United States, because he was intent upon getting America into the Second World War, was willing to sacrifice the lives of almost 3,000 American citizens and leave them to die at Pearl Harbor, knowing full well that the attack was going to come, even knowing the exact time the attack was going to come? And, of course, instead of allowing the naval commander there, Admiral Kimmel, to put the fleet to sea as he wanted, or certainly to have the planes in the air to intercept the incoming Japanese planes. We had our planes gathered together to make them an ideal target. We left our battleships in Pearl Harbor as a target to entice the Japanese to attack. And how do I know that? Because I have a copy of Henry Stimson's, Secretary of War Henry Stimson's, diary, and I'll be glad to send pages of it to any of you out there who question what I'm saying. I got them back at the Sterling Library at Yale University. And Henry Stimson talks about his meeting at the White House on the 25th of November, 1941, where he and President Roosevelt and Admiral Stark and General Marshall and Frank Knox, Secretary of the Navy, met together. And the President said, the attack is coming, probably will be this coming weekend. And, of course, the only question is how we are going to get into the war and get the Japanese to fire the first shot. They knew the attack was coming, they knew where it was coming, and they left the American boys there to die. David, what really, of course, got you to spend the time, to put the effort in, to write a book on Pearl Harbor?
Oh, I suppose it just grows out of my natural history, my natural interest in American history. I was brought up the son of a veteran of the Second World War, and as a matter of fact, most of the kids I knew, their fathers had been in the war. And the Second World War was a constant topic of conversation when I was growing up. It was something that was very real that had just ended just a few years before I was born. And Pearl Harbor was always brought up. Everybody knew about Pearl Harbor. Everybody remembered what they were doing on the 7th of December. And the question occurred to me quite early in life. I just wonder why it was that the United States was caught flat-footed and allowed its Pacific Fleet to be destroyed.
Hold that thought right there, David. Well, Dr. Stan, our guest is David Wade, and I'd ask him why he'd written a book on Pearl Harbor. And his response was, well, you know, people wondered why the United States government allowed the Pacific Fleet to be in. And then I interrupted him, so pick up the story there, David.
Well, I was just going to say, I remember, even when I was a kid, among veterans who normally, you know, they had fought the war, they were patriotic Americans, and they trusted their government, but I noticed there was always an undertone of suspicion about what actually happened at Pearl Harbor. And then I later discovered that there had been all sorts of investigations into it, that our commanders actually at Pearl Harbor at the time, Admiral Kimmel and General Short, had been dismissed and had been blamed for dereliction of duty. And I thought this was very strange, too, because these were men who had actually sterling careers in the military. And why would they be judged derelict in performing the defense of Hawaii, which is what they were appointed to do? That seemed to me to be a puzzle. The more I got into it, the more I discovered that there were all sorts of people who said, as a matter of fact, Kimmel and Short were not derelict in their duty. They operated on the best information that they had been given. And then I discovered that the government of the United States had withheld vital information from them about the prospect of an immediate Japanese attack on Hawaii. The great book written by John Tolan, called Infamy, was the book that really made the scales fall from my eyes. I saw there that there was a pattern of government behavior that went prior to Pearl Harbor. As a matter of fact, that went all the way back to the outbreak of the Second World War in Europe, and it all seemed to be headed in one direction, which was namely to provoke Japan into attacking us. And, in fact, to isolate and keep in the dark our commanders in Hawaii so that they would not suspect that the attack was about to fall on them.
And, of course, if you read Admiral Kimmel's report, he tells you he was getting repeated newsletters from Admiral Stark, Chief of Naval Operations, telling him when the attack came it would be in the Philippines, assuring him that the attack would be in the Philippines. And, of course, the Philippines had a copy of the code breaker, but the codes and the Japanese message were never allowed to the commanders of Pearl Harbor.
Yes, I mean, that was a very strange thing. Everybody knew about it except the commanders of Pearl Harbor.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is David Wade. And of course, we're talking about the fact that everybody knew the attack was coming at Pearl Harbor except the commanders at Pearl Harbor. And those of you who have seen that movie, it came out, perhaps 3 or 4 or 5 years ago on Pearl Harbor. And, in fact, it was very interesting. The timing was just perfect. Suddenly, we're beginning to see war movies just before 9-1-1. But on this war movie, it had Ben Affleck, and the first time I ever saw him. And, of course, they depicted the message being sent to Admiral Kimmel. And of course, you see, of course, the scenes of Pearl Harbor, the smoke, the ships going down, the planes shattered, the Japanese planes flying overhead, and here comes a little boy on a bicycle from Western Union to deliver a message to Admiral Kimmel to tell him the Japanese are going to attack at Pearl Harbor because they knew when the attack was coming. And certainly General Marshall had actually been forced to send a message, but instead of sending it by radio so that that Pearl Harbor could have been prepared, they could have put the fleet to sea, the fleet to sea, they could have, you know, got their planes in the air, they could have been prepared.
That is one of the most mysterious episodes of the whole tragedy, and later on Marshall lamely explained that he didn't want to use a radiogram to inform the commanders in Pearl Harbor because he was afraid that the Japanese would intercept it and then they would know our communication system. But this is exactly the same system that Roosevelt and Churchill used to communicate with each other before Pearl Harbor. And yet no one raised that objection at that time. So he resorted eventually to sending a Western Union telegram.
And here comes the little boy on the bicycle to tell him, you know, after the attack is already well underway and thousands of Americans are dead, they're going to tell him, oh, gee, there's going to be an attack. You know, well, we told you there was going to be an attack. Why weren't you prepared for it? And they did everything, of course, to conceal the truth, exactly as they're doing today. When are the American people going to understand? It's like deja vu all over again.
Mm-hmm.
Well, David, let's give some of the particulars. Really, of course, who is Colonel, Commander McCullough, Lieutenant Commander McCullough? What are the significant things about the fact that, for instance, Robert Stennett has brought out in his book?
Well, Lieutenant Commander Arthur H. McCullough was a naval intelligence officer and also a friend of Franklin D. Roosevelt. They knew each other and had known each other for many years. Roosevelt had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy during the First World War. In October of 1940, McCullough wrote an 8-point memo. And he explained in the preface to this memo that it would behoove the United States to provoke Japan to attack it so that the United States could go to war to Japan. We were already doing everything we could, short of war, to aid Great Britain in Europe. We were unsuccessful in trying to provoke Hitler to attack us in the North Atlantic, and therefore we should provoke Japan, Hitler's ally, in the Pacific. And if we got embroiled in a war with Japan in the Pacific, this would take pressure off of Great Britain and help Britain prosecute the war against Hitler. And we, by we I mean the Roosevelt administration, followed that memo to a T. We did, in fact, violate Japanese territorial waters. We did, in fact, institute an economic embargo against the Japanese. We did, in fact, negotiate with Great Britain the use of the port of Singapore for our fleet. Every single thing that he recommended in that 8-point memo, the Roosevelt administration executed.
But, of course, the most significant thing was to cut off all access to oil for Japan. People could imagine what would happen in the United States. If they were to put an oil embargo on the United States so we couldn't buy oil anywhere in the United States, and we had no domestic sources at
oil,
all.
Yes, oil was the lifeblood of the Japanese Empire, and in particular, of course, the great Japanese Navy, which was their strongest military arm. And the Japanese Navy could not survive more than a matter of a few months after we totally embargoed their oil.
And, Chris, that was really an act of war on the part of the United States government to embargo a nation and prevent them from getting oil.
Under international law, that is correct. It was an act of war. We committed very many acts of war secretly against Japan. The embargo, at least, was an open act of war. We entered into negotiations with the British and the Canadians and the Chinese. And those were also acts of war under international law that the American people did not know about.
And so we were doing everything we could to get the Japanese to attack. The American people didn't want to go to war. They'd fought the First World War, and they realized, of course, it had all been a lie. We lost 125,000 killed and probably twice that many injured in a war we never should have gotten into, but they were lied to. In fact, actually, the man who was hired as a propagandist was a man named Edward Bernays, who we often quote.
Edward L. Bernays,
right.
Yes, the King of Spin, they called him.
That's right.
A public relations expert.
And he did convince the American people the First World War was the war to end all wars. Wouldn't it be worthwhile fighting and maybe even dying to end all wars? But it was all a lie. It was the war to make the world safe for democracy. Doesn't that sound sort of like what we're fighting for in the Middle East today? We want to bring democracy to the Middle East?
Well, that is the justification, isn't it?
Right.
We're going to bring democracy everywhere in the world. Of course, the interesting thing is that so many of our allies are anything but Democrats. But we're not talking about overthrowing Saudi Arabia, for instance.
Nope. And so it's all hypocrisy. Hypocrisy, always hypocrisy. But the American people are so incredibly gullible. But in 1941, the American people realized they'd been lied to by their leaders who'd forced them into World War One with the terrible loss and suffering, and so they didn't want to get in World War Two. They weren't worried about England and France. They had brought this thing on. They had done everything they could to, you know, and at that time the American people knew that the English and French had built up Adolf Hitler. But the American people today have never been allowed to know that. Of course, they don't know that American financiers had also financed Adolf Hitler both before and during the war. But we're not allowed to know that today. But be that as it may, the leaders of this country needed an incident to get us into war. They needed
I'm sure that's exactly what Roosevelt was thinking, and that was in line with the McCullough memo, because one of the points of the McCullough memo that I did not mention, but obviously is of vital importance, is that he recommended that our Pacific Fleet be moved from their safe harbors on the California coast to Pearl Harbor.
And, of course, the Navy didn't want to. Admiral Richardson was in charge. Admiral Richardson, who was chief of naval operations, chief of the Pacific Fleet, said this is a terrible thing to do, and he went to see the president.
He had a confrontation with Roosevelt in the Oval Office, and he was dismissed from his command and replaced by Kimmel because Richardson said it was a foolish thing to expose the American fleet by moving it to Pearl Harbor.
But, of course, he realized, of course, it would be an ideal target for the Japanese. And so did President Roosevelt, but they had different motives. Mm-hmm. Admiral Richardson wanted to protect American lives in the fleet. Franklin Delano Roosevelt wanted a target so the Japanese would attack so we could get into the war. And so Admiral Richardson at least had the courage to do what was right, unlike so many military commanders today. And Admiral Richardson then was discharged because he refused to risk the lives of his men and the American fleet.
And he was replaced by Kimmel, who was made a sitting duck. For instance, just before Pearl Harbor, commander-in-chief of the United States Navy at that time, Admiral Harold Stark, issued an order that kept the fleet in Pearl Harbor. Just before that, it had been out, it had sortied, and it was out in naval exercises. Then Admiral Kimmel received an order that the fleet was to return to Pearl Harbor and stay there at further notice and under no circumstances, and by no means was it to leave port.
But, of course, they took the aircraft carriers out because they didn't want to lose them. And so they had them on the way to Wake Island, and they left the five battleships there, because they realized that they would not be that significant as far as the rest of the war.
Yes, if
we were to lose them,
that's true. And one of the battleships that was sunk in Utah was already obsolescent, and the other battleships were their keels were laid in the period either during or immediately after the First World War, and as it happened, they were sunk in shallow waters. And all of them were later raised, with the exception of the California, I believe, and of course the Arizona, which was obliterated. It blew up, and half of the sailors that died at Pearl Harbor died in that moment when the Arizona blew up.
And they're still interred there. They're still there. They're skeletons. They were never recovered.
Yes, and The attack itself was a great success for the Japanese, and I think it was a greater success than Roosevelt expected it would be, because they were able to launch torpedoes in shallow water, and we were counting on their inability to do this, but they had developed a new torpedo that had wooden fins on it and would actually bounce to the surface because it would be buoyant and therefore could travel through shallow water and reach its target. The losses at Pearl Harbor, I think, were greater than the Roosevelt administration reckoned that they would be.
But do you think that they were worried about the loss of American lives, or do you think that maybe they felt it was just, well, the expense of getting us into the war?
You know, this is the objection I've often met with about my book, because people say, well, okay, Franklin D. Roosevelt may have been a sly politician, but he wasn't a moral monster. Would he actually be willing to sacrifice the lives of thousands of American servicemen at Pearl Harbor?
Pull that stuff right there, David. Well, our guest is David Wade, and please continue your thought. You were asking the question. You've been challenged on your book by people who say, well, Franklin Delano Roosevelt wasn't a moral monster. He wouldn't have sacrificed the lives of Americans there at Pearl Harbor knowingly, would he?
Well, I believe that he was quite capable of taking that risk because he thought the stakes were as high as they were. He had a vision. He had a world vision. The United States at the end of the war, along with Great Britain and the Soviet Union and China as a junior partner, would form a sort of condominium that would be policemen for the world. And he wanted America to play this role, and in order to do that, he had to get into the war. And remember that it was at the close of the Roosevelt administration, and certainly with his knowledge and consent, that the United States instituted a policy of forceful repatriation of German prisoners of war. And I know that you're particularly interested in that topic, and we know it's been estimated that somewhere in the neighborhood of 900,000 of them probably perished. They were handed back over to the Soviet Union. And this was done under the Roosevelt administration with the knowledge and approval of Franklin D. Roosevelt, because he wanted to appease Joseph Stalin and keep on Stalin's good side. So I would say that a man like that would also be the sort of man who would be willing to sacrifice the lives of a few thousand sailors and Marines at Pearl Harbor.
And there's nothing new about this. Commanders have often sacrificed one group for a greater good. Certainly they left the people at the Alamo to die so that they could rally the people against the Mexicans during the Texan War, the war with Mexico at that time, and sent General Sam Houston intentionally prevented people from going to help defend the Alamo because he wanted a rallying cry. Do you remember what it was?
Remember
the Alamo.
And yes, they did remember the Alamo, right.
And that's exactly what they did at Pearl Harbor. Remember Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's remember 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And the similarities are really so shocking. And until we can understand there really are people who are monsters, who have no moral conscience, who are quite willing to allow people to die in large numbers simply for a greater good. And the greater good was we had to get involved in World War II.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've often regarded that as a failure of moral leadership. Roosevelt could have honestly made the case to the American people that he could have said, look, we have a situation here, we have a war in Europe. The Nazis are evil. Although we are not immediately threatened by Hitler, nonetheless, there is a moral case to be made that for the sake of civilization, we should extend all aid short of war to Great Britain, because Great Britain is resisting Hitler. And I think the American people would have subscribed to that. As a matter of fact, they did in increasing numbers just before Pearl Harbor, but that wasn't enough. He wanted to get America directly into the war so that he could...
Hold that thought right there. We've got to bring our other stations back on board here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is David Wade. And David was saying that President Roosevelt, rather than going to the people and telling them the truth, of course, actually manipulated the Japanese into a position where they had to attack and then, of course, left the ideal targets there at Pearl Harbor. But it was for a greater good, at least from his perception. He had made the decision we had to get into World War II. He had already committed to Winston Churchill, we would go to war. It was just a matter of how they were going to have an incident to rally the American people behind the government, so similar to what had happened at on 9/11, where the decision had already been made to go to war with Iraq. And if you doubt that, you can certainly read the book, The Price of Loyalty, by Paul O'Neill, or go to the Project for the New American Century website at newamericancentury.org. That's newamericancentury.org. And read the letters that were sent to President Clinton in 1998 and 2000 and understand the decision to go to war with Iraq was made long before George Bush became the President of the United States. And in a similar manner, the decision to go to war with Germany and Japan was made long before the attack on Pearl Harbor. Pick up that story, David.
Yes, I was going to say, in their famous meeting at Argentia Bay off the coast of Newfoundland, Franklin D. Roosevelt and Winston Churchill came together for the first time. And there is evidence to indicate that Roosevelt, in fact, entered into a secret treaty with Churchill, pledging that if the British colonies in the Pacific were attacked by the Japanese, we would go to war on the side of Great Britain. This is totally unconstitutional, of course, because only the Senate of the United States can make a treaty, and also it requires a declaration of war by Congress in order to get America into the war. So, actually, Pearl Harbor resolved a dilemma for Franklin D. Roosevelt, because at the same time the Japanese attacked us at Pearl Harbor, they did attack British possessions in Asia. And that meant that Roosevelt would not have to face this dilemma. Either I honor my word to Churchill and expose myself to possible impeachment, because it will come to light that I had violated the Constitution, or I don't honor my word to Churchill, in which case my whole grand geopolitical scheme will collapse. He never had to face that dilemma because the Japanese attacked America at the same time, so he could go to Congress and ask for a declaration of war, which, of course, he received with an all-but-unanimous vote. There was one congresswoman who voted against it. It would have been interesting to see what would have happened if the Japanese had not attacked Pearl Harbor, but had attacked the British possessions in Asia. Then what would have Roosevelt have done? He may very well have ended up being impeached, and he knew that, because he had pledged extra-constitutionally to get America involved in the war in the Pacific anyway, even if the United States were not attacked, if the British were attacked there.
Well, I think that there's so much to the story that the American people have not been told. Now, of course, they had a series of investigations. But the president called, and they would have congressional investigations, other investigations, and it's almost like the 9/11 investigations. They were all aimed at concealing the truth from the American mm-hmm. people. Would you like to talk a little bit about those?
Well, David? Just briefly, many of the key witnesses were not called. They were not called because they were military personnel. And they were informed by their superiors that they could not testify. And Congress would have, in theory, the right to subpoena their testimony, but Congress did not. I'm talking about any number of people, for instance, who claimed that they saw the famous Winds Execute, East Wind Rain, which was the message that we were told to expect if war was going to break out in the Pacific.
Now, this was a Japanese message that was
right.
being sent to Japanese possessions,
right.
and
right.
we knew its significance.
Right. And there were all sorts of military men, Royal Ingersoll and Carlisle Dusenberry and Moses Pettigrew from the Office of Naval Operations, all later said that they saw the message, too. There was one man who did insist on testifying, and that was Captain Lawrence Sanford. And he was more or less drummed out of the service. They said that there was something wrong with his head, and they remanded him to psychiatric treatment because he claimed he saw this message, which nobody else would have the courage to come forward and testify to having seen.
Hold that thought right there, David, as we'll, and when we get back, we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and our guest this evening is David Wade. His book is Infamy Revisited. Fascinating book, fascinating insight into what happened at Pearl Harbor, because if you don't understand Pearl Harbor, you certainly can't understand what happened on 9/11, when we had another Pearl Harbor. In fact, people have often referred to this as another Pearl Harbor. In fact, in a publication put out by the Project for the New American Century, and you'll find it on their website at newamericancentury.org, it is called Rebuilding America's Defenses, and there in this 75-page treatise, they talk about how we're not going to be able to have the new programs that these elitists want for America unless there is another incident like another Pearl Harbor. And those are their words, not mine. They understood how Pearl Harbor was used to mobilize the people to go to war in 1941. And they wanted an excuse and a means of getting America into a war in the Middle East in the year 2001. So pick up the story. What about these investigations that were held?
Well, there was an official naval court-martial of Admiral Kimmel. There was a Army Board of Inquiry into General Short. There was originally an investigation by Secretary of the Navy Frank Knox, another one by Associate Justice of the Supreme Court Owen Roberts. But all of these were all the witnesses were controlled by the government. In the case of Knox and Roberts, of course, you had two members of the administration itself that were investigating Pearl Harbor. And in the subsequent investigations, the testimony was controlled by the military. There was one final investigation that did take place starting in 1996, many years after the other investigations had ceased, and this one was conducted by the late Senator Strom Thurmond of South Carolina. And this investigation actually exonerated, after all these years, Kimmel and Short, and said that they had not been derelict in their duty. Of course, they were long dead by the time this took place. But the recommendation that they be exonerated was not signed by President Clinton at the time on the advice of the Defense Department.
That would be President Truman.
No, this was when Bill Clinton was president.
Oh, I see. Okay,
yeah,
go ahead.
This was back this was the investigation that was begun in 1996, and I believe it was 97 or early.
Hold that thought.
Wound up.
Hold that thought.
Yeah.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, David Wade, is talking about his book, Infamy Revisited. He's saying that there was an investigation in the mid-1990s of what had happened at Pearl Harbor. Of course, Admiral Kimmel and General Short were both dead by this time. There was a conclusion that they were not guilty, but President Clinton refused to sign the statement saying that these people were exonerated.
Exactly.
I wonder why that was.
He said he was acting on the advice of the Defense Department.
Right. Of course, the Defense Department could never allow the American people to know the truth that we left those men to die at Pearl Harbor.
Well, it's typical of any bureaucracy. You never admit that you made a mistake. And even after all these years, they were not going to admit that in the case of Admiral Kimmel and General Short.
And, of course, they were not going to admit that they were willing to kill those American boys, leave them there to die with no chance at all of escape. for the greater good. And what people don't understand is that the lives of American servicemen have been sacrificed over and over again, for purposes which no one in the American public has been allowed to know. There is another agenda. And, of course, the reason for World War II was to create the United Nations and bring about a world government. When you understand that, you understand what energized these people. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. So a series of investigations, the Roberts investigation, the various congressional investigations. Finally, a Naval Board of Inquiry, though, did, I believe, after the war, didn't they actually exonerate Admiral Kimmel and General Short?
Well, no, they were not actually exonerated until Bill Clinton was president.
All right.
And that was due to the efforts of the chairman was Strom Thurmond, and it was former Senator William V. Roth who started the investigation at the behest of family members of General Short and Admiral Kimmel.
Well, I think what a terrible tragedy is when courageous military officers are betrayed by their own government. And, of course, the cover-up is carried out by the controlled media in the United States, because even in those days, much of our media and much of our information was carefully filtered by the people who were running things behind the scenes.
Well, I think we ought to pay attention to Iran right now. I've been reading some things that are really startling. For instance, Vice President Cheney has requested that the Defense Department draw up plans for a nuclear attack on Iran. This may seem startling. There's an article about it in a magazine called The American Conservative, which is published by Pat Buchanan. And they claim that they want to destroy Iran's nuclear facilities and that conventional weaponry would be insufficient to do this because they're sunk deep in the ground, protected by concrete, and it would require the use of tactical nuclear weapons. And Cheney has, in fact, ordered the Defense Department to draw up contingency plans for a preemptive nuclear strike against Iran to destroy their atomic reactors.
But, of course, if we can justify a preemptive strike on Iran, how could we object to a preemptive strike on New York City or San Francisco or Los Angeles?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's precisely the point. Once again, at least you can say about Franklin Roosevelt that he did end up going before Congress and asking for a declaration of war. And, of course, he had arranged things so that there was no way in the world that he wouldn't get one. But we have been involved in one undeclared war after another since the Second World War. And you wonder, has the Constitution of the United States fallen into desuetude? Is it now defunct? Whatever happened to the constitutional provision that requires that the elected representatives of the people approve our going to war with another sovereign nation?
Well, of course, what happens is the Congress usually votes to support the administration. They have repeatedly voted to support what's going on and appropriate money for it. All they would have to do is just withhold the money, say we're not going to appropriate it, and the war would come to an end.
That's
but
right,
unfortunately,
the
Republican Party, and I hate to say this because I'm a lifelong Republican, the Republican Party is betraying our country by perpetuating this senseless war, which is a stepping stone to expanding the war in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. I agree with you.
That's right, and we should not look at this as an isolated incident because this is part of a strategy. You mentioned the project for the 21st century. And we all know about Mr. Wolfowitz and Mr. Pearl and Douglas Faith and all of these people who for years before the 9/11 debacle were talking about waging a series of wars to destabilize all these regimes in the Middle East that we don't like because they are enemies of Israel. And their scenario is now being played out.
All right. Mm-hmm. Let's go to John, who's calling us from Michigan. Is this John?
It's Joan.
Joan. Okay, fine. Okay, Joan, go ahead.
I wanted to tell you, when I was at Michigan State in 1976, I was a history major.
Right.
And one of my professors, there were only about 8 of us in the class, and he got us a pamphlet from the archives, Roosevelt's archives in Washington, D.C., and he told us, since in the pamphlet, that Roosevelt knew ahead of time, like you said, about the attack on Pearl Harbor. They had broke the code, magic intercept tapes.
Oh, yeah, we had broken the diplomatic code, and that was common knowledge, as a matter of fact, even before the war was over. What we have recently learned is also that we have broken the Japanese JN-25 naval code, or at least a large part of it had been decoded by the time of Pearl Harbor. And the most startling revelation is that at the U.S. Naval District 14 in San Francisco, we had actually intercepted the radio traffic of the Japanese fleet that was headed for Pearl Harbor. We could not decode the messages, but we knew that there was a large body of ships out there. We knew that they were Japanese ships, and we knew that they were headed towards Pearl Harbor. That would have been their logical destination. And all of this information was doubtless conveyed immediately to Franklin D. Roosevelt, because the man who was in charge there was Commander Richard T. McCullough, not to be confused with Arthur McCullum, who was another close personal friend of Franklin D. Roosevelt's and had his private phone number at the White House. And it's highly likely that McCullough would have jumped right on the telephone and let Roosevelt know that the Japanese fleet was headed towards Pearl Harbor. This was just a couple of days before the attack itself.
Yes, I understand that. Also, I wanted to mention, in 1976, that was the year I graduated with my Bachelor of Arts, and I was recruited on campus by the CIA, and I was so naive at the time, I really didn't know what the purpose of that branch of the government was, that it was such a shady group of people. But I did read a lot of spy novels,
mm-hmm.
and I knew it had something to do with something military or something like that. Anyway, the first thing the guy said to me at the meeting, he met with me at a local hotel, and he asked me if I could kill anybody. And I said, no, and I just walked right out of the meeting.
Well, back then there wasn't a CIA, but there was a forerunner of the CIA called the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services.
No, I think she graduated in 1976, didn't she?
1976,
right. Yeah, there was a CIA then, but when I say back then, I mean at the time of Pearl Harbor.
Right.
There wasn't a CIA, but there was the OSS, and there was a guy by the name of William Donovan. They call him Wild Bill Donovan, who once again was another close personal friend of Franklin D. Roosevelt's. And the story is that Donovan was actually told by the German chargé d'affaires, that is to say the guy who was substituting for the ambassador, because we had officially severed our diplomatic relations with Germany, a guy by the name of Hans Thompson. And Donovan was trying to get Thompson to defect, because Thompson was secretly an anti-Nazi. And Thompson refused to defect, but he did tell Donovan that he had found out that the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor. And indeed, the Japanese had informed Hitler of this before they attacked Pearl Harbor, and Thompson found out about it. He told Donovan. Donovan was head of the OSS, another close personal friend of Franklin D. Roosevelt's, and once again, I would find it very hard to believe that Donovan would not have told Roosevelt.
Anything else you want to say, Joan?
No, I'm all set. Thank you for having me on, Steve.
Well, thank you. Whereabouts do you live there in Michigan?
I live in Allen Park, Michigan.
Is that close to Detroit or Flint?
It's closer to Detroit, downtown Detroit.
Okay, fine. Well, thank you.
I'm only about a 20-minute drive from Detroit on the expressway.
Well, thank you. Please encourage the other people that you know there to listen to our program, because we need to educate all those people in Detroit.
Well, I'm going to be going back to teaching this fall, and I'm certainly going to inform my children about what you said.
And, of course, they can listen to our program 5 hours a day on the Internet. But at RadioLiberty.com. Good night.
Thank you.
God bless. Bye-bye. And, of course, the CIA does recruit people here in the United States, and many of these people operate in the United States in violation of the law, but who are you going to report it to? And of course, if you create too much of a fuss, why, you'll end up, well, you'll end up like Lee Harvey Oswald or yeah. Jack Ruby or...
Well, the
or
CIA is a government within the government.
Right.
And not even Congress knows where they get their money and how they spend it. There are a few heads of committees, I believe, that are privately informed about it, but it's not public knowledge, and Congress as a whole doesn't have access to that information. And they are, in fact, accountable to nobody except the President of the United States.
And I'm not even sure they're...
And I'm not even sure of that, because there are all sorts of stories about how the CIA is actually...
Well, I think that we have to understand the CIA runs people for Congress and has their people in key positions mm-hmm. in Congress. And a perfect example would be a man named Gross, Peter, the man, I've forgotten his first name, but he is now the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. He was a longtime agent of the CIA, and then he is suddenly elected to Congress. And he ends up in charge of the Intelligence Oversight Committee. In other words, he is the man who's in charge of checking on the CIA, and yet he is a longtime CIA operative. And then he leaves there to become the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. And you might wonder what he was doing in Congress. Was he really checking on the CIA, or was he serving the CIA? Mm-hmm. There was another man. He was a member of Skull and Bones. And he was elected to Congress. And then, of course, he became the director of the Central Intelligence Agency after he was elected to Congress. And then he became the Vice President of the United States. And then he became the President of the United States. His name was George Herbert Walker Bush.
Yes.
And today his son is the President of the United States. Is that simply by accident?
Well, you know, there are all kinds of interesting connections there, aren't there? Well, Skull and Bones is an interesting... connection, too. Both George W. Bush and John Kerry were members of Skull and Bones.
Right. We had a great choice in the year 2004.
We had our choice between two different bonesmen.
Right. And you wonder, when the American people are ever going to wake up to what's really going on? Well, let's get back to infamy and really what happened as far as at Pearl Harbor was concerned, because certainly this surprise attack had a tremendous emotional impact on the American people, didn't it, David?
Yes,
were the American people ready to go to war at that point, even though on December 6th almost nobody wanted to go to war?
Well, it did exactly what Roosevelt calculated that it would do. It united the country as nothing else could. He had been trying to provoke Hitler in the North Atlantic, and there were a number of incidences there where German U-boats had attacked American ships. But actually, under international law, in all of those cases, the German U-boats had a perfect right to attack American ships because they were convoying contraband of war to Great Britain. And none of those incidences really was dramatic enough to provoke the American people into demanding that we go to war with Hitler. Hitler himself gave orders that the German U-boat commander should avoid confrontations with American ships. So he did not rise to Roosevelt's bait. He was looking for some sort of really dramatic incident. And he got it at Pearl Harbor. Matter of fact, he may very well have gotten more than he bargained for, but he certainly got a dramatic incident. An incident where there was a sneak attack.
And it really wasn't a sneak attack. And afterwards, after the war, certainly, pardon me, after the sneak mm-hmm. attack, why, there were people who recognized that Roosevelt had known exactly what was going to happen, mm-hmm. had staged the whole thing and left the people there to die. But they justified that by saying, well, we had to get into the Second World War.
As a matter of fact, one of the interesting characters in this whole mosaic is a guy by the name of Commander Rochford, who was in charge of intelligence on Hawaii at what they called Station Hypo, where they were decoding Japanese whether we're decoding Japanese intelligence. And he said that. He said, well, this was a cheap price to pay.
No, because it was a cheap price to pay if it was somebody else's son. If it was your son or your husband, it was too much of a price to pay. And in some respects, that's just what happened on September 11th. It was a cheap price to pay to get us into the war with Iraq. And yet, of course, if it was one of your friends or one of your relatives, why, it was a very, very high price to pay. But the president did everything he could after Pearl Harbor to keep from an impartial evaluation, from an impartial investigation. And George W. Bush did exactly that after 9/11. He did everything he could to block the initial investigation. And then when they were going to have it anyway, why he insisted on withholding information, classifying information, and censoring the report before it was ever released.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what they did.
The incredible thing is, to this very day, the government is still sitting on all kinds of classified information about Pearl Harbor, claiming that it would not be in the public interest to release it because it would reveal state secrets and be adverse to our national security.
And, of course, are they trying to keep Hirohito from finding out?
Well, that's the big question. What is it now, after more than 60 years the war has been over, what is it now that's in those documents that could somehow jeopardize our national security?
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is David Wade. His book, Infamy Revisited, and I think it's a very important book. We actually have a four-tape set on this. We have the book, Day of Deceit. We have Infamy, which I think is an excellent book. David's got an excellent job of pulling together all of the facts, going into the background of what happened. What sort of response do you get when you do programs on this subject today, David? Are many people interested in what happened?
Well, it's on a very wide spectrum of responses. You'd be surprised there are people who interview me who know nothing about the subject at all. I mean, I've heard people interview me that they start the interview by saying something like, well, so the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, huh? I mean, this is the first time they've heard of it. Then I have other people that are quite knowledgeable about it and interested in it. I have a lot of people who are incredulous. They just find it difficult to believe that our government would do such a thing. Now, one of the things I say is that you have to consider this, that there is controversy over these facts, and the evidence is necessarily circumstantial. I mean, we don't have any sworn testimony by anybody. I don't have a videotape of Franklin D. Roosevelt sitting in the White House saying, well, we're going to let the Japanese hit Pearl Harbor, and I'm not going to warn our commanders in the field. Obviously, that would never have happened. So you're never going to have that sort of direct evidence. The evidence is necessarily circumstantial, but I think the pieces fit together logically. However, when I unroll this argument, I am constantly met with incredulity by people who just do not believe that our government, the good old USA, would ever be involved in this sort of perfidy. But what I tell them is, okay, you can dispute the circumstantial evidence about whether Roosevelt actually knew that the attack was coming and knew it was going to be Pearl Harbor that was going to be attacked, but there is something that is a matter of public record now which no historians dispute, and that is that Roosevelt followed a policy of violating international law for a couple of years prior to Pearl Harbor, that he entered into all kinds of agreements with the British, the Dutch, the Canadians, and so forth, all of which were flat violations of international law because they were violations of our neutrality.
Hold that thought there for just a moment. Our guest has been David Wade, and we're talking about Infamy Revisited. Well, David, I want to thank you so very much for being with us this evening. It's always a pleasure to have you here on the program, and we're looking forward. I think we have another program later this week.
Yes, we do.
And good night, and God bless you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And I think David's point is very well made. It's very obvious that President Roosevelt wanted to provoke the war because he'd repeatedly ordered that we violate international law and that we do all sorts of things to provoke the Germans because he wanted to get into the war. Well, if you're interested in knowing more about his book, Infamy Revisited, why, or you'd like to get know more about Robert Stennett's book, Day of Deceit, or the four-tape set that we have dealing with this, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like, of course, to get a free copy of our latest newsletter, which is on the occult hierarchy, second part two. And you have to understand there really is an occult hierarchy that rules the world. And if you don't believe that, you go to the on Google and type in occult hierarchy. And there you'll see the articles and references to the Theosophical Society, that is one of the most powerful organizations in the world today, ties into the Lucis Trust, ties into the World Goodwill, ties into a whole network of invisible organizations. But they're there, they're very real, they have offices throughout the world, they have people planted at every level of our government. And they talk about the occult hierarchy and the plan, which includes the idea of a new world government, of a new world order, and a new world religion. So go to their websites, and you can get them by just typing in occult hierarchy on your internet. So and then if you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, give us a call, and that's the June newsletter, the Occult Hierarchy Part 2. If you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or, as you can certainly go to our website at radioliberty.com, and you can pull down the May newsletter, which is Occult Hierarchy Part 1, the June newsletter, which is Occult Hierarchy Part 2, and you will know more about what's really going on behind the scenes than 99% of the people in our intelligence agencies or working with certainly at the highest levels of our government today, because I suspect there are very, very few people in our government who really understand what this is about. There are a few who know exactly what it's about, but many of them are influenced by the supernatural forces that are able to control the minds and souls of men. So we simply don't tell you what I think. We tell you what they say. And we have their publications. They're available for you. Please read them and understand what we're up against. We're up against organized evil. If you have not yet seen the videos, They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll, the 3, 4, or 10-hour versions, why, if you'd like to know more, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you would like, of course, to tell others about our programs, we would appreciate it, because it's up to you to help us build up our listening audience. And then if you go to our website at radioliberty.com, you can listen to our programs 5 hours a day on the Internet. And then, of course, after the 5 hours a day, you can listen to the archive programs, and there's about 3 hours a day of archive programs you can listen to. They go back about 6 weeks. And you certainly are welcome to pull down the newsletters going on our website, going back many years to give you an insight into the true nature of the spiritual battle that is being waged today for the souls of men and for the survival of Western civilization. So again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Our website is radioliberty.com. And so we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders and for our ministers, because we're told to do that. We ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection, because we're on the front lines of a truly spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. Until tomorrow at the same time, we'll be back with you once again. Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.